Καλησπέρα σας και καλώς ήρθατε στο The Greek Shipping Podcast με τον δημοσιογράφο Μινά Τσαμόπουλο και εκλεκτούς καλεσμένους από τον κλάδο της ναυτιλίας. Καλή σας ακρόαση!
Alex Χατζηπατέρας, thank you for accepting our invitation to have this podcast. Let's begin about your family's history. Could you tell us about your family's history in Greek shipping industry and how you became involved in it? Is the second question. Let's start from the history, family's history, and because it is very interesting.
Thank you, Minas. Thanks, Kibernitis, for including me in the podcast series, which I've listened to many of the others, who are great. My family has a long history in Greek shipping on both sides. It started on the Hadjipatera side for over 100 years ago. It was something, we come from a small island called Enousis near Turkey. And it was a way to get a better quality of life there, to go out and seek to gain opportunities and improve and make a business for yourself. And this continued for generations, even through adapting into the steam age and evolved with time. In fact, in Enousis, it was one of the first islands where they put a syndicate together for a ship called the Maria Terali. Many different families came together, pulled their money to allow them to survive. Many islands have stories where families didn't survive into the future. They bought the ship together and started the next journey of the steamship age. So it's a long history, but I think they were businessmen, but there have been captains along the way, of course, so with sea experience, but more businessmen that took advantage of this opportunity.
They wanted to transfer all the goods, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the world trade, and what was the advantage we had in Greece was the knowledge of the sea, coming from the island nation like Norway, Greece, and this was something that they could capitalize on, and was very close to their heart. So this was the origin. Of course, whenever there's a long history and origin like that, you respect it, but you also have to look forward and how to survive and evolve for the next generation.
You feel proud for your origin, huh?
Until I moved here to Greece more permanently, I didn't appreciate fully the way and the role of the name historically, because growing up...
I didn't have the whole picture.
Yeah, and growing up in America more... it's a big country with many different, let's say, industries. And here, shipping is really respected. And there's a knowledge of the different companies that have been involved and families. So it's a heavy weight, but something to be very proud of as well.
What was the first step in your history, your family's history? Who was the first that was involved in shipping?
Well, I described a little bit from the Hadjipatera side, but for Dorian, as we discussed earlier, the first was my grandmother, Maro, or Maria Liris, who married Hadjipateras, and she started the tanker company Dorian in 1973, Dorian Hellas, which was one of the first Greek tanker companies to become active in VLCCs and the larger tanker segment. At that time, there was still quite a barrier to entry. There weren't so many companies operating both technically and commercially, the bigger ships like that. And although it was considered a little bit risky because you're carrying oil, took the decision to do that and built a name and evolved with the time in tankers until 2002, when Dorian took the decision to move into liquefied petroleum gas, initially through pressurized gas carriers. So we're talking about 3,500 CBM. They measure in CBM, 5,000 CBM, a little bit like the one Stealth Gas is operating today. And then subsequently in 2006 and 7 into the larger segment, very large gas carriers, which is about 45,000 deadweight, 80,000 CBM.
Your grandmom, she has the experience these times to be involved in shipping.
As an investor... And less so on the day-to-day, but yes, following the new building order book as a shareholder. And she was always very positive about gas as a future. Gas, both LPG. She had some crystal ball, I don't know. Yeah. As a, I think, was a risk taker, and okay, in early 2000s, it was considered a little bit a niche, not now referring more to LPG, but for Greek companies, there weren't so many companies active in that segment. So both on the technical and commercial side, it was important to stake a place and do the operations, because we were offered on many occasions, okay, build the vessels and we will operate them for you, both commercially and technically. And not only did we decide to do all the commercial in-house, but we decided to build a crew, because we didn't have a gas experience crew, to build our own crew from Croatia. And then that's what we did. We hired a lot of ex-crew members from another Northern European company that had shifted regions, and we built the Dorian crew.
So we started from scratch, or she was a shareholder at these times, your grandma?
The company started from scratch, but the initial funding was an inheritance that she invested. So she, let's say, risked the inheritance to start a tanker company, but not from zero, zero.
A very dynamic person, your grandma.
Very much so, and some people used to say it was like she had two computers working in her head, very bright, quick. You know, I think in Greek shipping, we're lucky to have a few examples of very successful, like Nino Martinos, that are dynamic and have really taken companies and transformed them.
Athena,
yes, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes.
I mean, so we can say that she was a pioneer in Greek shipping.
I think so, yeah. Maybe not as well known as Nunu, but for sure on the tanker side and within that segment, yes. And at the time that a lot of the shipbroking was done in London, and should work with Braemar and these different shipbrokers, because there was a lot more asset play done in the 80s and 90s with these tankers, because they were secondhand tankers. And in addition to trading, you would make money from the fluctuations in the valuations.
And I think that she faced the crisis in the 80s.
Correct. Hmm? Yeah. Yeah, it was.
What happened there?
I remember being told as a child about layup and shipping layup, and how when the markets were bad, you could walk from one ship to the next because they were all here in Panama or wherever. You know, I think in the worst case scenarios, you had to work with your banks. It was very important to have a good relationship with your banks. Maybe extend some payments, but this was depending on their faith in you as a counterparty. And at that point, you realize how the name, the quality of the relationship matters, because it's easy in the good times to make money and reinvest. But in those times, which are inevitable in an industry like shipping, which is so cyclical, you know, you had to live another day. So it was trying times, I remember. But yeah, even as a kid, I actually remember every time the ship was unfixed. Even I was 8 or 9, I remember that we're waiting for a cargo. But you know, it was a roller coaster from the chartering perspective. Yeah.
And your father, when is he involved in shipping?
When he left school around 18 or 19, he started immediately wanting to be, but not immediately an entrepreneur. First, he started to work with his father. But then he had a desire to change things and kind of lead the way. And at that time where he was, he couldn't find an opportunity to do that. So it so happened that his mother had just divorced, and she was eager to start a company. And that's how they started Dorian together. So
your grandpa was in shipping too, eh?
Correct. He was in the multi-generational company on the dry segment. But yeah, my father morphed towards tankers as an opportunity. And he started investing in ships in, I think, Norway that were selling for just a small amount above scrap value. So these are tankers, a couple of, and trading and trying to keep another voyage going. And sometimes it would be very successful and make enough money to buy another vessel and et cetera. So it was high risk. And they also survived through the high interest rates. Now, of course, we talk about fluctuation in interest rates, but then it was Paul Volcker, and you had a floating interest rate in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had one time charter where the time charter rate was fixed, but the interest rate was floating, and it almost made the company go bankrupt. But they were able to get the ship out of this time charter finally, and then not be limited on the upside. But the interest rates went up to 15-16% at that time to try and curb the money supply in the U.S.
I want to ask you, your father was brought up in the USA.
My father was born in the United States, in New York. However, he grew up in London, like many of my family members. So all his childhood and schooling, except as a teenager, he came to Athens College. So he came around 13, 14, 15 to Athens College and was in boarding school there with many other people in the industry, like the Tsepnirises and, you know, Lyris and Alex Kedros. They were school classmates.
And when he diversified the ships, the type of the ships, your father, and go to LPG?
So the core before LPG was tankers and some ore oilers. So like we had these ships that carried both dry and wet cargoes. 2002 was a diversification to LPG. Again, another sector where there, we felt there was a barrier to entry, so it, we could be a leader there. And then mid-2000s to the bigger ships, and in 2012-13, we really had the decision, should we exit the sector or expand? And we saw in the U.S. that the cargoes, the production was increasing of shale gas, and LPG was considered non-critical resource in the United States. Some of the natural gas or LNG they wanted to keep for domestic usage, for energy security. But LPG was going to be, had to be exported as part of the NGL stream. And that's how we decided to expand the company. And we did a joint venture with Secor, which was a publicly listed company, 50-50. And we went initially to Norway, to the over-the-counter market with Dorian, what then became Dorian LPG.
You have seen the opportunity then.
Exactly.
I think that he had the right information.
We saw the opportunity. The shipyard prices were at historic lows. Nobody was ordering ships. So it was a complete alignment of stars between shipyards having no business, in a way the opposite of now, and the LPG increasing. But you're right, if he hadn't seen a little bit forward, because obviously if everyone saw, then they would have gone to order. So we were lucky because when we ordered the initial new buildings, we were able to get some options. So 3+3 options and then another option. And it gave more flexibility to the company as it was now, talking about the public company, as it was nascent and growing up.
Why your grandmom baptized the company Dorian?
Dorian is related to the Doric tribe and the history of Greece. And it's something that, you know, maybe it's a word we know, but perhaps isn't known as well internationally. And as you know, this is the story is really to reflect the history of Greece and the beautiful architecture and the tribe, but nothing beyond that. That is the reason why. And now it has become a well-known name in the industry.
Do you remember some stories she told you from shipping or from Greece when you were a child?
I remember a sign she had on her desk that said, "The best man for a job is a woman." I remember that she was very tough and, you know, many Greek parents or grandmothers, they say, "Oh, you will be wonderful, Minas, as a journalist." And she was like, "Okay, thadume, pas tha pas." So no sugarcoating, but in a way it was refreshing because, and also the emphasis on hard work, that no matter what, without hard work, you won't succeed.
And where are you involved in business, in shipping?
Today, I'm working here in Athens, managing the office here in Athens, and I'm also working on projects like new business, sale and purchase, and I'm a director of The Pool, which is a joint venture that we have with MOL, the Japanese company. I also participated in the roadshow when we went public in Norway, so explaining to people what our view on the market was. And we have, as we stand today, aside from Athens, where we have the licenses for managing the vessels, and we also do our finance and accounting, we have an office in Copenhagen, which is our commercial headquarters for chartering and commercial operations and fleet performance. And then we have a corporate headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut, where I grew up near there and where my father sits and our corporate CFO is also there.
Do you remember your first day at the office when shipping?
I remember my first official day. I was actually in Japan. I had gone to Sumitomo Shipyard for the sea trials of the Oklahoma, which was a 105,000 deadweight Aframax tanker. And I remember arriving in Japan, and it was a very nice way to be. I thought growing up that I had an appreciation for the industry, but once you start working, it's completely different. So I was there with a superintendent, Date-san, because in the Japanese shipyards, you're restricted in terms of the site team you can have, so it was somebody local. And I spent about a month there going and inspecting different blocks, seeing with class all the steps along the way, the approvals. And it was a kind of nice way to step into the industry because it was a slower pace, but it gave you literally an understanding of from the block above up how the ships were made. And then as the market developed and we would charter the ship, I had this memory of having been there at the initiation.
Let's go. Your father's experience in the shipping industry is quite impressive, as the experience of your grandma. How has his experience influenced your career and approach to business development and commercial strategy?
Well, I really respect how detail-focused my father is. So he may be reviewing a dry dock report or looking at some new big commercial venture. And so I really respect the fact that he can look at the details but also see the big picture. Very dynamic, classic entrepreneur, so always thinking forward, huge drive, never satisfied, which is tiring sometimes to work with, but very respectful, of course. You know, it can get too comfortable. But, you know, I think to be successful in a company where you work with a family member, you have to, as much as possible, try and create some, not boundaries in terms of when you speak time, but separate the roles as father and boss. So,
crucial. This is crucial.
You know, it's very crucial out of respect for the two positions. And I remember, now you mentioned my grandmother, discussing this with her when she was more operational. And she said, it's not black and white. You can't do it perfectly. Don't aspire to. But, you know, Monday to Friday, it's sort of boss. And then on the weekend, you can wear the family hat. You know, again, without being too idealistic, we try and keep this separation.
Which are the characteristics that you admire in your father?
The drive, the never being satisfied, passion for the industry. I think, you know, loves going to visit vessels. He'll go on a Christmas day or some day that this may be a holiday. So a genuine appreciation and love for the ships, but not to the point where he lets it impact a commercial decision in the sense of ultimately, the goal is for the company to survive and survive. So this is the best thing that we can do. But really enjoys that it's a people business. It's tangible. You can see the asset. And so these are what I really respect.
It's better to manage your company from here, from Greece, or from USA, London these days.
London definitely has lost, I think, the allure. It's a wonderful place to visit. A lot of the shipbrokers are there. But it doesn't. We're happy now in Copenhagen commercially. From the U.S., it's good for us for speaking with investors and some of the banks. But I mean, I'm here, so I'm completely partial to Greece. I think as a manager, you have access to great talent pools. The schools now with the tech have not only tech, but there's more focus on developing industries as well and other skill sets aside from pure technical and marine. So I'm very impressed with how Greece, even since the crisis of Grexit, when companies said, and we had to have a plan B then, whether we never wanted to leave was something else, but our customers said, if something happens, what will you do? So for us at the time, we were looking in Cyprus. But now that that abated, we're very happy here. And I think that Greece has stayed strong and has improved even as a ship management hub. And you see it with a reflection of the amount of people that come to visit Greece. The amount of meetings I've had here with other companies or business development opportunities because they're visiting someone else and they see you as well, it's great. It's like osmosis.
Which are your experience with the new buildings that you have started? How has this experience helped you to go on?
It helped me because after my experience in Yokosuka in Japan, I went immediately to Ulsan, to Hyundai, the biggest shipyard in the world. And we had experience as a company building in their Samho yard, Okpo, which was the offshore, and main yard Ulsan. Being there was completely different because it was so much focus on production in a good way, but they're producing many more ships. And I had a chance to attend the technical negotiations there with our site team, Helix, which is a very long legacy as well, the Frangoulis family. And so to sit for the technical negotiations, see the vessels in a more dynamic environment than Japan was a great experience in Hyundai, and also formed the seeds of a long-lasting relationship that we've had with the yard, because by far it's the biggest yard that we've ever collaborated with.
Hyundai.
15 ships or something on the
Hyundai. Korea.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you see the shipping industry evolving in the coming years?
Well, we've a lot of talk about this, but there are huge, let's say, challenges on the horizon regarding how we move to more sustainable fuels and energy sources. Not to be too optimistic, but I think it can provide an opportunity for companies to continue to differentiate themselves if you take a lead there. But we will go through another rebirth as an industry, and it's a matter of making a plan and targeting these with in a financially viable way, but to start thinking outside the box. So we carry LPG on our LPG carriers. So for us, it's a natural step as a fuel, as the next fuel. But this is also a stepping stone maybe to other fuel sources that could be cleaner. So we're participating with different think tanks like Mærsk Mc-Kinney Center in Copenhagen. Maybe we'll also look here locally in Greece to try and come together with other technical managers and leaders in industry on where to focus the efforts. So it's challenging. I don't want to dismiss the seriousness of the challenge. Exciting as well. It's also exciting to see the role of sustainability and that management makes a big impact and difference in how people and our customers think of the company. Sometimes, maybe 5-10 years ago, you could have perhaps a different shipping model where you have a very small corporate office, you outsource everything to third-party manager. Now I think both the third-party manager structure and the independent shipping structure have changed. You have third-party managers like V-Ships here who have a collaboration with the owners. So they have maybe cross-pollination. They have their system, but they have some people like from the owning company there. Or you have us, which you really do everything independently, but you try and collaborate. And I think all of that cycle, both commercial and the technical, are part of your calling card to a customer. They want to have that one-to-one relationship.
As we are talking about the cycle, do you believe that the cycle of a ship is shorter these years?
Another good question. I think if you look at the steel and the technical side, in theory, no, especially for a gas carrier that can last very long and maybe even go into storage. The risk is if you don't build the ship dual fuel ready or retrofit ready, that you could become obsolete for other reasons, commercial reasons. So I think if we were to do new buildings today, in order not to have that be the case, we would look very closely at, you know, how the deck is or reinforcing certain areas to be able to retrofit. But I don't know, on LNG, you see different tiers of ships. So you have generations there, so first, second, third generation. And in a good market, they all do well, maybe with some slight discount. But in a bad market, then you're going to see the clearing out of the older ships. So it's a risk, I think, I have to be honest.
How do you imagine the future of the shipping for the next 10 years?
More automation, increased focus on digital tools like AI. This is probably 5 to 10 years. I think it's been an amazing ride to the last few years where the sector is doing very, very well. So perhaps there could be some oversupply at points that you have to work your way through. But the industry is still going to be critical. And hopefully we'll continue to focus on better quality of life for human or for the seafarers, more diversity. So I think challenges aside from the technical around the new fuels is going to be shortage of crew. that's one area. I mean, whether we get more automated, still there's a shortage of crew for all the new ships coming. And probably the other is the environmental, continuing to present to the world all the steps that we take to be a cleaner industry, because historically shipping hasn't, I think, gotten the respect that it deserved for how we carry cargoes. In fact, I just completed a degree in France, a business degree, and we were talking about how many companies, big corporates, are focusing more on shipping transport versus air transport for supplies that are not essential. Companies, I mean, like Pfizer or big, because of the benefits and the cost overall in terms of the travel, it's much better in terms of overall emissions. So I think shipping is definitely here to stay, but there'll be big changes.
I wanted to ask this question. What do you think that would be the future of LPG as a fuel?
As a fuel for domestic usage or as a...
For everything.
For everything. I've done so many conferences around LPG, and in certain parts of, let's say, the East and in Africa, it's such a great fuel as a stepping stone to a cleaner way, like, because it's easy to distribute in canisters or through trucks. You, before having a grid system, LPG is a great stepping stone to other solutions. So LPG, I think, will continue for all these countries that are evolving and catching up to be a great fuel source, and also play a role in the petrochemical mix as it does today in China. As a fuel for shipping, I see all the class presentations. I think LPG can be bunkered quite easily, but it seems to have found its home mostly on LPG carriers. So I think that perhaps the upside there is capped. There's a lot of talk about ammonia and other fuels. But as an energy source, I think for the next 10, 20 years, it's going to be one of the most viable. And I've seen it firsthand. I've spent time in West Africa, in Senegal. You know, it's, you could there before you can smell the charcoal and the burning. And LPG, it's something, and the safety issues have been dealt with on the canisters. Any concerns around safety or aftermarket sales? Every year, the LPG the world, they have a forum every year, and they talk about the safety release valves and how to make the domestic consumer comfortable that they can use that as a cooking fuel. So I think, you know, in India and other places, it's going to continue to help them make it to the next.
That is a bright future.
Bright future. But it's a byproduct. And someone said to me, you always have to remember LPG is a byproduct, either of crude oil processing or natural gas. So the LPG will continue to grow and be moved, but it's somewhat under the radar compared to, let's say, the LNG and crude oil. Many people in the industry like it that way. So, okay.
Do you discuss Indoor to invest in another type of ships?
Always, we keep an open mind. So there are other types of ships that are close to gas. You know, there's LNG, ethane, ammonia. That's something natural for us. With these are markets that we see, even mid-sized gas carriers today, they can carry different cargoes. So, yes. And then if we were to look at something completely different, like dry, would be purely opportunistic if felt that the market was there. But I think shipping has been proven that companies that diversify, now I'm not only public, I'm not so sure, but independent companies that diversify, they outperform because of benefiting from different stages in the cycle.
Let's go to Greek Shipping now. I have a lot of questions, but let's follow them. Greek Shipping is considered a world superpower. What do you think are the characteristics that contribute to this success, particularly among Greek ship owners?
Definitely the history, but history is not enough alone, because there's a history but a relevance still today and new companies that emerge. Okay, we talk about the size of the fleet, be it tonnage or vessels. I think it's that the Greece has evolved with the times. Many companies went public like ourselves. So you see them also on the public exchanges. You see very successful private companies like Thanamaris.
And last years, we see a lot of spin-offs. And
a lot of spin-offs, like now with Stealth and Imperial. or even Navios. So
Palio,
of course,
Simeon Pitas,
very successful. So I think that Greece has adapted with the times. They always had a reputation, from what I know, correct me if I'm wrong, being successful at asset play and taking vessels that maybe some technical skill to operate in the phone, but they evolved in the new building market, public market, and have kept current. And this is, I think, the biggest, that shipping is considered, you know, like part of the ethos of the culture here, but continues, and we continue. And still today, the talent pool, like I mentioned, is very strong. So I love being in a country where this industry is celebrated in the way that it is.
No, Greek ship owners told me that we're watching what the Greek ship owners doing and follow them.
I've heard this too, yeah, because of the timing and
the time, yes.
Never wanting to overpay or sell to
cheap. So they invest in a sector that nobody has seen that.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yes. But I'm always sensitive about this because some people say, oh, whatever Warren Buffett does, you do. But no, I think I respect, you know, people like Thanasi Martinus and Eastman that have amazing timing. But at the end of the day, you make your own decision up and, you know, just a lot of mutual respect for those companies. Like containers, that many Greek companies went into containers right before the market went through the roof. So again, you see a willingness to diversify from what is known to something a little bit different for the Greek market, at least, when not Hamburg. And then the benefits of that accrued to those companies. Or even
believe
as you said.
The Greeks have the instinct, have the right information, they risk, or a bit of all this?
I think it's appetite for risk, taking calculated risks, not betting the whole, and instinct. Okay, we're all chasing different information and stuff, but at the end of the day, to act, you need this instinct and appetite for risk. So they're willing to do that, and so have a strong stomach for, you know, maybe we all see the headlines when the market turns, but you have to survive a year, 2 years, maybe before that, because again, if from the beginning it made money, then it wouldn't have been so obvious, or everyone would do it.
Well, for more than 2 or 3 years, as we have seen it in a dry bulk.
Yes.
In the dry sector.
Yes. Yes.
The last 2 years, 10 years.
Absolutely, with Capes and yeah. Big ships not making a lot of money, and just again, trying to do everything that you can to stay there, stay in the market, have exposure, because the minute the market turns, it's impossible to find a ship, you know, at that moment.
I think that this is one more secret. Try to stay in the market in bad times.
I agree.
Huh?
I agree.
Because while it tells,
it's impossible to find a ship, or, you know, the prices make it so unrealistic. It's very true. So I think having having the cards to play the next game is very important. And it's very difficult sometimes, you know, right before the market turns, you exhaust all your patience. And you have to have the courage deep down to say, you know, even if I've tried to restructure the loan and all of this, I'm going to live to see another day. And, you know.
Let's go to the new generation audience listening to this podcast. Is there a specific message you would like to share? Your advice to the young people, to those who are interested to pursuing a career in the shipping industry?
I think that if you're young and you don't have exposure, and I gave a chat recently at Alba Business School, and it was seven of us on the stage, and half had a family connection and half started from scratch. So say you don't have a family connection, it's very important to take advantage here of tools like the Institute of Chartered Shipbrokers or the Yes Forum to build those connections and network. And you can definitely do it because there are forums available to try and connect you into the industry. I know historically it's been considered a closed industry, but I think, and I'm speaking on the commercial side as well as the technical, because technical, maybe the pathway is more, tried and proven. But I think taking advantage of that community here is very valuable. And there are many, including myself or George Savlerius, owners who want to give back to the industry and see the next generation succeed there.
There are opportunities for the next generation.
There are opportunities in shipping. The markets have been good. People are investing. People asked me this question 7-8 years ago when the markets weren't very good. And I remember even in London, a colleague of mine, his son wanted to go into shipping. He got a job in a ship broker and the market was so bad, the ship broker said, I'm afraid that I won't keep my job. Now it's a cyclical business and we've had a good cycle. Also, there is this more tech companies. So Signal is perhaps the most famous, but there are other companies, marine traffic, or that are doing shipping from a technical digital perspective. So you can combine skills that even if you don't use them with shipping, they're very relevant, but they're also relevant data architect. In fact, these are some of the skills that we find the hardest to find, cybersecurity, data architect. But those are a good way if somebody wants to be in the industry and stay here in Greece. I think that's also a good avenue.
The new technology, I have heard you, Adelfos, you said that they give the chances to manage the fleet different ways, better ways.
So there are many companies, a huge amount of companies in the last several years, that tried to change how we communicate with the ships and present like a dashboard of information to us. Initially, that was on consumption, to reduce consumption. But one of the big bottlenecks was the connectivity to the vessels. So we would still have blind spots around the Indian Ocean. So the feeds would get delayed, batched up, and then come later. And the point I tried to make at Delphi was that with companies like Starlink, the low orbit satellites, ideally, and we're seeing some good initial results, the connectivity will be much faster. You won't have these blind spots. And that enables a much better handshake with the vessel. So all those big promises can be more fulfilled because you'll have better connectivity with the vessel. And we can respond more real time rather than just collecting data. And also removes the possibility of errors or idiosyncrasies with the data. So this is a very nascent happening now. Also, I heard some good feedback in America from companies using Starlink. And there are other companies doing the low orbit satellite. But I hope, when we talk about 5 to 10 years from now, it will be a truth rather than just a promise.
Looking at your grandma with a photo behind you and knowing that the two most important supporters are ladies, Maria Angelikousi and Angeliki Fragou. Can you repeat the motto that your grandma had on her office about women?
Yes, of course. My grandmother had a clear sign on her desk, big letters. It said, the most important man for the job is the woman. So she was a kind of feminist, I guess you could say, at that time. But, I think it was something very memorable and wonderful to grow up with.
Alexander Pateras, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minos. Thank you, Kibernitis.